And greetings, welcome to the Dividing Line. We have a cold front coming through Phoenix right now, and it's probably the last time till late November, early December, that I can wear. You know, I was sitting here saying it's the last time I'm going to be able to wear a Coogee, and I look to my right, and what do I see but Rich, the window, clapping wildly.
Yeah!
I mean, you know, people know that this makes me happy, but does he care? You all don't see what we endure here, the persecution, instead I just get told that I'm the mean one. I tell you. But yeah, it's not even going to make 70 today. So, you know, here in Phoenix, anything in the 60s, you can actually justify wearing a sweater for. So probably be our last shot. And so or as you all say in other places of the world, wearing a jumper today or a woolly. Make sure to put on your woolly. Strange. Anyways, yes, we will try to get to the phones eventually. We have a couple things to get to. I found it interesting this morning. I received a tweet from Cheryl Lyle, and it says 9 hours ago. And what's interesting is she specifically followed me to tweet this message. So I see on my screen the follow notification, immediately followed by the tweet. Addressed to me, it says, "For the sake of multi-millions worldwide, would you kindly read Kathy Baldock's book, Walking the Bridgeless Canyon? Thanks." And then there is a tagging, evidently, of Kathy Baldock, because she's going to get involved in this conversation. And so I looked it up. Because I found that an unusual request. And I asked, should I expect something other than the regular diet of ahistorical, emotion-based revisionism that I have read in the dozens of other such books? Maybe serious Bible-based coherent reasoning and argumentation? I think that's a fair question to ask. I mean, for asking somebody to read an entire book, I looked it up. It's on the LGBTQI, RSTUV, WXYZ stuff. And I've read a lot of books on that subject. Maybe Michael Brown's read as many as I have. Interestingly enough, I'm not sure that Bob Gagnon reads as many of those books as I do, because he started talking about he was examining Brownson's book and Matthew Vine's book, and he says, "I'm just getting around to reading them. I read them years ago." So, you know, Bob Gagnon focuses upon, you know, the super high end scholarly stuff, but I've read Jewish books on the subject and allegedly Christian books on the subject, and I haven't found a Muslim book yet, though, you know, Bassam Zawadi might be able to point me to somebody, because he monitors a lot of that stuff. And that's still another fascinating area to me, that particular intersection of things. But anyway, I've read a lot of these books. And so I'm like, well, am I going to be just reading the same thing I've read before? Or is there going to be something new here? And what's interesting is that there was a response from the author that said to my question, "My book has never been described by a series of descriptors that you've used. Perhaps you should read it and see for yourself." Well, what was the series of descriptors that I used? Ahistorical, emotion-based revisionism. That was one series. And then the other was serious, Bible-based, coherent reasoning and argumentation was the other one. Well, so none of those have been used? I don't know. So I respond to that by saying, okay, I've read at least two dozen pro-LGBTQ books, from Vines to Lee to Brownson to Michelson to Ochtemeyer, and there's lots of others. Found them all presuppositionally and foundationally flawed. How is yours different? And the response I got was, perhaps do as I do when I want to know if a book has integrity and research and content. I read the reviews on Amazon. Oh, I'm sorry. My response was, well, that is the last place I look for meaningful information, I assure you. Marketing is not my interest. Just asking what makes it any different than all the other revisionist material I've already examined. I'm sorry, but I see the reviews on my own books. And I know that half these people didn't even read the book. You just know these certain people. I mean, sometimes in the review, they'll say, I won't read the book. So Amazon reviews, last thing I would ever look at along those lines. And so I found that strange. So Cheryl Lyle, who started all of this and clearly wanted to get this conversation going, popped in and said, Kathy speaks truth. Thank you so much for your research and passion for truth for the multi-millions worldwide who were born as LGBT. Only the fundamentalists choose literal translations instead of contextual truth. The Bible is copies times copies times copies. Now, what does that mean? I mean, there's really no rational meaning to that. What do you mean the fundamentalists choose literal translations? Are you talking about the New American Standard versus the NIV? What do you mean literal translations? I don't think Cheryl has any clue what she's talking about. And then she said the Bible is copies times copies. It's actually copies of copies of that's the Bart Ehrman thing. To which I responded briefly, whenever I see someone parroting the copies times copies times copies line, I know they have yet to even begin to hunger for truth. And then her response is, see, James, you just can't accept truth. I feel terrible for you and anyone who listens to you. Bye. She started this, and I'm just responding back going, do you have anything meaningful to argue here? Elsewhere, she included she quoted me. I'm looking at her tweets now. I also mentioned in response to her, a Bible scholar who, because she mentioned something about, here we go. And by the way, I am desperately hungering for truth, and that's why I even began this thread. But I know I will never find it with you. I have high, reputable Bible scholars I am in dialogue with who don't think they have the truth like you do. Just think about that one for just a second. To which I responded, a Bible scholar who doesn't believe the Bible is what Jesus taught it was can only bring you confusion and disappointment. Your statement about copies is, of course, false and verifiably so. Doesn't that concern you? And her response to that was, fundamentalism and literalist. Ugh, I am out of this conversation. Well, yes, goodbye. You are the weakest link. I just found that whole thing rather interesting. If it was a marketing ploy, it did work as far as I did pick the book up on Audible, and I got through the first three chapters on my ride today. I get the feeling that anything related to the Christian faith is just going to be tacked on at the end, because so far there's been nothing about Christian worldview or anything. The introduction, you know, sort of gave an idea of what's going on here and what's happened in this person's life. But, you know, so far it's just been a very, very one-sided history of psychiatry and psychoanalysis and, you know, stuff like that. And so, well, something tells me it's going to be just a recooked version of Vines or Lee or whoever once we finally get to a few Bible sections a little bit later on, so we'll see. Anyway, let's get back to part of our work here, and then we'll open the phones a little bit later on, and get to that. We're trying something new today. Yes, indeed. I was actually, the whole reason I've stumbled into these, he says as he drops it on the floor, the only reason, it's so small. The only reason, and you know what? This has larger thingamabobbies in the package, doesn't it? They're not in here. They must be someplace else. Up there. Definitely gonna need the larger ones. This is for little teeny, teeny, tiny little ones that sort of bobbles around. Anyway, I was looking for a Bluetooth range extender. For some reason, even my MacBook, even though it's less than 10 feet away, there's something about my window, the sliding glass door and the outside wall there. I can't Bluetooth anything out there in the gym when I'm working out. It just won't get through it. So I was looking for a range extender and stumbled onto this. I started reading about latency stuff because, look, folks, we've been using a 1980s vintage earbud, hardwired in for me to be able to hear what's being played and talk to people on the phone and stuff like that. And it's like, so I don't remember how long ago it was, a year and a half or so ago. I said, let's use Bluetooth, man. I'm tired of this. This wire gets in the way. It looks dumb. Well, there's a thing called latency. How long it takes for the thing to process and get it into your ear. And so I'd say something and, over a second, second and a half, sometimes 2 seconds later, I'm hearing it. And that doesn't work. So I said, forget that. Well, I ran across this thing called, I forget what it was, but low latency stuff. So you can watch TV and listen on Bluetooth. And so we just got it today. And, I can hear myself and it's very low latency. I can detect just a little delay, but certainly not enough to cause any problems. So we're going to try, and this is how I'll hear the callers too. So, we don't know how long the batteries last, and we didn't really have a chance to, charge them up all the way. So if they die, I left the 1980s technology over there just in case we need it. So, but we're going high tech. We've got a Bluetooth thingamabobby wobber here that we'll use. Okay, now. Let's talk a little bit about, I'm going to deal with one particular assertion and really go into depth on this, but I think this is important. This is one of Bart Ehrman's normal arguments. It's found in the debate. Let's just go ahead and listen to it and hear what he presents, and I'll pick up the speed just a little bit. Here we go.
Let me move to the end of Jesus' life, his death and resurrection. It is interesting that both the Gospel of Mark and the Gospel of John tell you exactly the day on which Jesus died. It was sometime around the Passover feast when Jews would celebrate the Passover, the Exodus from Egypt, by having a lamb slaughtered in the temple on the day of preparation for the Passover. You prepare the Passover meal, which involves eating lamb that night. The lambs get slaughtered on the day of preparation. And that night is when the next day begins in Jewish reckoning. The next night, the night's the next day. When it gets dark, that's when the day begins in Jewish reckoning. So in all the Gospels, Jesus dies sometime around there somewhere. In John's Gospel, John is clear. Jesus dies on the day that they are preparing to eat the Passover, the day before the Passover meal is eaten. Mark's Gospel is also explicit. Jesus dies the day after the Passover meal is eaten. You don't need to take my word for it. Look it up. Mark chapter 14, verse 12, and then Mark chapter 15, verse 25. It's the day after the meal was eaten. John chapter 19, verse 14. It was the day before the meal was eaten. They're explicit, both of them. But how can it be both? Now, you might say, look, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I mean, he died sometime around there, fine. Okay, but it actually matters to John, and it matters to Mark. It matters to John because John is our only gospel that says that Jesus is the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. John is the only gospel that says that, and he has Jesus killed exactly when the lambs are being killed, to show that he's the Lamb of God. It matters to him when Jesus died. And it matters for Mark that Jesus died the next day. Because for Mark, when Jesus gives his Last Supper, it's a Passover meal. So that the Christian, the Lord's Supper, is a replacement of the Passover meal. It's important to both of them when Jesus died, but he dies on different days. They can't both be right. If you're asking, are the Gospels accurate? Well, one or both of them had to get it wrong because Jesus didn't get crucified two different times. He got crucified once. There are a number of implausible things that you find in the gospel accounts of Jesus' death. The most famous one.
Okay, there's the presentation. Okay, and Lycona is going to roll over on that one. Go, yeah, but it's not a big deal. But yeah, John definitely has Jesus crucified on a different day, and I'm with Ehrman. If John is doing that, that's a serious problem. There's no question about that. And there are lots of theologians who like the idea. I think that, yeah, that's what John's doing. John's emphasizing that Jesus is the Lamb of God. There's only one problem with that. John never says that. Where in the crucifixion accounts do you have anything about, and by the way, this is when the lambs were being slaughtered. And the Jesus is slaughtered the same time. You know, that's just theologians going, oh, that would mean that, and therefore it must be what he's thinking. Well, I mentioned before that what I'm going to present to you is not anything new. And there, this answer to this allegation has been around for a long, long time. Again, I forgot to grab it, but one of my textbooks in college had in the back an appendix by A.T. Robertson that went all through this and does a fine job. Just remember that when it comes to this kind of thing, in most schools today, you're simply not allowed to give the benefit of the doubt to any type of orthodoxy. If it's been what Christians have believed in the past, you can't go there. You're not allowed to do that. You are not allowed to go with anything that would allow the text of Scripture to remain consistent with itself. Doesn't work. You're not allowed to do it. Now, what I'm going to present to you is a meaningful, consistent. I've never heard Ehrman even mention it, even try to interact with it. And to be honest with you, I don't think he ever would, because to interact with it is to give it more credence or respect than I think he thinks any type of harmonization deserves. So here's, and I, like I said, I think I first presented this particular, thing, this particular keynote section at the Jeremiah Cry convention in New York a number of years ago. I don't remember how many years ago now. But you know, somebody could look it up and tell me, but it was a while back. So, Bart Ehrman makes the assertion there is a fundamental, clear contradiction. It'll come up eventually. There is a fundamental, clear contradiction without possible explanation between the Synoptics and John as to whether Jesus ate the Passover and hence upon which day he was crucified. That is, was he crucified on 14 or 15 Nisan? Nisan being the Jewish reckoning of the month. And you just heard that presentation. He chose only a few weeks ago to make this one of his primary arguments against the accuracy. He's saying this is an inaccuracy that cannot be explained merely on the basis of Lycona's arguments about narrative and Plutarch or anything else. This is a theologically motivated inaccuracy in history. And from his perspective, that means that's it. He wins the debate. Okay? So, let's look at the facts. The Passover lamb was slain on the afternoon of Nisan 14. And those of you who study Jehovah's Witnesses should know that, because that's when they have the memorial supper, is on Nisan 14. The Passover feast, this is important, the Passover feast, unleavened bread, began that day with the Passover meal that evening, the beginning of Nisan 15. Now, as Dr. Ehrman mentioned, one of the reasons he gets away with this is that most of us think so much in modern Western ways of thought that a day begins at midnight, not recognizing in that not only do you have a difference there between the Romans and the Jews, but for the Jewish person, the day begins at sunset. And this throws, it makes it confusing enough that you can make all sorts of accusations against the narratives. So the Passover lamb slain the afternoon of Nisan 14. The Passover feast began that day with the Passover meal that evening, the beginning of Nisan 15. So the Passover meal is at the very beginning of the first day because that day changes at sunset. So Nisan 14 ends at sunset. Nisan 15 begins after sunset. The synoptics all agree that on the first day of unleavened bread, Jesus sent Peter and John from Bethany to make preparation for eating the Passover meal. So Matthew 26:17, Mark 14:12, Luke 22:7, that's the same Martin passage that Ehrman made reference to just a few moments ago, and we heard that. Now, of course, if you actually believe that John wrote John, this is even more significant because you'd have to actually posit the idea that John the Apostle knows, writing later in history, what's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, knows they've already recorded these things, and he's still willing to change the story that he was involved with. Now, of course, Ehrman doesn't believe John the Apostle probably ever existed, or if he did, had nothing to do with the writing of the gospel that is named after him. But you would have that issue. Clearly, in the synoptics, Jesus ate the normal Passover meal and hence was crucified on Nisan 15. So when you think about it, so you've got the Passover meal and you have the establishment of the Lord's Supper and then you have the garden. This is all in the nighttime. You have the betrayal. You have the overnight. But this is still all one day, remember, because the day started at sunset. You have the overnight trial. Next morning, you have the crucifixion. In the afternoon, you have the death and the burial as the sun's going down. This is all on Nisan 15. All on Nisan 15. So they're all united with that. Many scholars, including modern and mainly conservative scholars, have concluded that John has Jesus eat the Passover on Nisan 13. So that he is crucified at the same time as the Passover lamb on Nisan 14. And that's what Ehrman is referring to. There are five relevant passages in the Gospel of John to examine. Ehrman says that clearly John contradicts the synoptics. Unfortunately, this debate, Mike Lycona collapses on that, says, yep. But is this so? Let's look at some of the passages. John chapter 13, verses 1 through 3. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world of the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God and was going back to God. I guess I cut it off at that point. Okay, there's verses 1-3. It is assumed, on the basis of this being before the Feast of the Passover, that this means it was 24 hours before, that is 13 Nisan. But this requires us to read Feast of the Passover, and here, this is the key. This requires us to read Feast of the Passover as referring only to the initial meal, not to the entire celebration, which lasted an entire week. That's what people miss. And I think part of the problem here is that we as, especially Western Americans, don't have multi-day holidays. We may talk about the 12 days of Christmas, but who seriously celebrates 12 days of Christmas? And so when we think of the Feast of the Passover, we think of a singular event, that one meal, which is just the inauguration and opening of the Feast of the Passover, which lasts for a week. Instead, the text speaks of Jesus doing things during the supper, which is clearly the normal Passover meal. John would have to expect his audience to be utterly ignorant of a bunch of stuff that he assumes they're not ignorant of anywhere else in the gospel, for people not to recognize that what's going on with the cup and the disciples reclining and this is the Passover meal. But it's the Passover meal that starts the Passover feast. But John's not trying to say that. If he's trying to make this point, he would have had to have said something to differentiate this supper from the supper that everyone would have been assuming they're talking about, and that is the Passover meal that initiates the celebration. Let's look at John 13:27. Then after he had taken the morsel, Satan entered into him. Jesus said to him, "What you are going to do, do quickly." Now, no one at the table knew why he said this to him. Some thought that because Judas had the money bag, Jesus was telling him, "Buy what we need for the feast," or that he should give something to the poor. So now it is assumed that the disciples would not have thought Judas was going to make preparations for the feast if the Passover meal itself was already over. Hence, this must be 13 Nisan, not 14. But there is no reason to limit the meaning of the feast to the Passover meal only, but to the entire feast of unleavened bread, which makes the statement consistent with the synoptics. And if there's anything that we can say about modern schooling and modern way of thought, you don't want the statement, you don't want to take the position that makes the Bible consistent. You're not going to get published that way. You want to take the position that makes the statement as inconsistent as possible. Then John 18:28. Then they led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. It was early morning. They themselves did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled, but could eat the Passover. Now, does eat the Passover means simply the Paschal Supper? No. The term Passover is used 8 times in John besides this instance, and each refers to the Passover festival, not simply the supper. So each time it refers to the week-long festival, not just to one portion of that, which is the inauguration of the longer festival itself. So even when you go back in the Old Testament, you see in 2 Chronicles 30:22, so they ate the food of the festival for how long? 7 days. 7 days. So here you have biblical examination, biblical illustration and example of referring to eating the Passover for 7 days. So, if at any point during that time the Jewish leaders had engaged in activity that would defile them, then they would have been concerned about this during the whole week, not just on Nisan 13, which is what people want to assume because, again, they forget that the Passover is a week long. Since this comment is made early in the morning, so when the Jewish leaders make that comment about not wanting to defile themselves, that's made early in the morning. This must mean the festival and not merely the supper, which has already passed, as any impurities would pass away at sundown. So in other words, if the idea was this is Nisan 13, the impurities are done by sundown, so they could eat that evening if they wanted to. So they're talking about the festival. Well, there would have been activities during the day that day that they would not be able to participate in until that evening. So it can't be simply the supper, and the whole idea falls apart as you examine it in this way. Let's look at John 19:14. Now, it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, "Behold your king." Now, here's, again, this is, we've talked about this in the past in regards to the 3 days, three nights issue a number of times. But we always have new listeners, we always have new viewers, and so we've addressed many times the question, what day of the week was Jesus crucified on? Because if you've got the prophecy, 3 days, three nights, we hear that very literalistically and go, that means it needs to be, 72 hours, not with a smidge of difference, which, again, is not what any of the original writers would have been intending in the first place. And when we see preparation of the Passover, we see the word preparation, and we go, that's the day that you prepare all the stuff for the Passover. So it's the Passover's next day, so it's Nisan 13 again. But this is the problem. The very word, there is no word Friday. I mean, obviously, in English, Friday would not have existed at that time. And each culture had different names for their days. And especially under the Romans, this led to, the necessity to adopt sort of a almost secular, or at least, you had, if you're a Jewish person and you're using your days of the week, you still have to be able to communicate with people around you. If you're doing business with them, whatever else it might be, you have to be able to say, I need delivery of such and such on such and such day, and you have to use terminology they're going to understand. But the term for Friday in Greek, to this day, paraskeuē, to this day, is preparation. That's the name for the day. To this day, even in modern Greek, it's preparation day. And so that throws us all over the place. It's actually nice, accurate thing, but we read into it what they would never have read into it. And that is, we hear preparation of the Passover, that means the day before the Passover, where you prepare things for the Passover, whenever that might fall. No, that's not how they would have understood it. It's the Friday of Passover week. It's Friday. And all the Gospels are accurately united in saying Jesus died on Preparation Day. Friday. I mean, it's just, That's the day for Friday. I mean, if we wanted to avoid the confusion at this point, instead of using the term preparation, we'd go ahead and render it in modern language the Friday of the Passover week. Because that's how clear it is in Greek. And how clear that would have been to the original audiences. And this is really just a place where cultural usage, language, translation throws us a curve. And we get all confused and go, what day was it? What? Hey, yeah, you know, that type of thing. So this says it was about the sixth hour. And he said to the Jews, behold your king. Preparation goes Friday. That is Friday, the Passover week. And the other thing is here, sixth hour in whose reckoning? It does seem that the Synoptic Gospels use Jewish reckoning, and John, writing at a much later period, uses Roman reckoning. Because then, you know, there's the allegation that they have him, Jesus dying at different times. You know, I didn't check into this. I'm not sure how I would. It would take forever. But I don't recall Ehrman raising the issue of the time of Jesus' crucifixion. Maybe he recognizes that that's not actually a valid argument in light of Jewish and Roman means of telling time, that they actually do say the same thing, as long as you just recognize who's using what. I'm not sure. So, John 19:31, since it was the day of preparation, and by the way, we'll go ahead and open the phones, because that'd be the next thing on the list would be your phone calls. Since it was, I'm sorry? Oh, you're already answering one? Oh, but people just don't have it memorized? 877-753-3341, 877-753-3341. That is toll free, I believe, is it not? Yes, it is. 877-753-3341. Since it was the day of preparation, so in other words, since it was Friday, and so the bodies would not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, so that Sabbath was a high day, because it was the Sabbath of the Passover festival, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and they might be taken away. So every day of the festival was a high day, including the Sabbath of the festival. Because it's going to be a week long, there's going to have to be a Sabbath in there, so it's going to be a high Sabbath. This does not mean the first day of the festival coincide with the Sabbath, which would be altering the timeline. So when you look at John, when you listen to what John says, when you allow for the feast of the Passover to be a week long and not merely the supper that inaugurates it, we see that John is in harmony with the synoptics on this matter. We see no evidence whatsoever that John is attempting to change things to make some type of theological point. And it really makes me wonder, to be perfectly honest with you, at the people who go, that sounds about right. Yeah, John must just make a theological point. We can let him have a theological point, no problem. It really makes me wonder, have they ever listened to this? Have they ever noted this stuff? I can't assume it, given the focus of theological education in seminaries today, this wouldn't be a part of that focus. And even back in the 80s at Fuller, this just simply wouldn't have even been presented as an option. Really wouldn't have. So there's... Now, I spent 20 minutes on that. Could we drop the... Drop that screen out of there, Rich. Appreciate that. So I can get my computer back. All right. Let me look here. I would say Ehrman 2 minutes and 39 seconds. I love Audio Note Taker. Great program. The section we played, I'm pretty certain I played around with it there, but about 2 minutes and 39 seconds in length. I spent more than 20 minutes responding to it fairly, honestly, and in depth. You can't do that in a debate. You can't do that in a debate. I understand that. That's why debates always have to be a starting place. And that's why, from my perspective, one of the things I'm doing in the debate is I'm trying to make sure that if someone does sit down and do the work that's necessary to really get meaningful benefit out of a debate and check things out, they'll find out that what I said does check out. I can't worry myself about people who aren't going to do that and or have their minds made up or are primarily influenced by emotion and by the visual and stuff like that. If I was overly concerned about the visual, I wouldn't be wearing my Coogee today. And Rich is agreeing in the other room. Two lines open at 877-753-3341 is the number. And so with that, we're going to be testing out. There's just a little delay. I can get used to it, but it actually slows me down a little bit. I don't talk as fast when that's happening. So let's go to the phones. Hope this works and talk with Bryson. Hi, Bryson.
Hey, what's going on?
How are you?
I'm doing well. I just wanted to ask you for recommended books on the resurrection of Jesus, because I know that you're not as happy to recommend Mike Lacona, and he has a big volume on it, and maybe guys like William Lane Craig. So what would be some books that you'd recommend on the resurrection?
I'm not real good as a bibliographical resource. That's not my thing. I don't keep track of things like that. Most of the stuff that I've read have been articles and things like that. What you got to do, even if you disagree with someone like Mike Lacona, that doesn't mean that the bibliography, footnotes, things like that are not useful. A work of that extensiveness, that size, you're going to find in the bibliography and in the reference notes a goldmine of information. And unless he's extremely selective in the sources he uses, it's going to cover a pretty wide range. So I, off the top of my head, don't know of just simply books just on that topic that would take any different perspectives. I mean, I'm sure there are some more conservative ones, especially when it comes to that issue of the zombies. I just hate that. That's just a horrible way of describing it. But issues like that. But I'm not saying to people, don't read Lycona's book on that subject. Just you have to read anything by anybody with discernment and you know, I certainly learned in seminary, you can read stuff that you disagree with and learn a lot from it as long as you read it in a discerning fashion. That's what's gotten me into trouble with a lot of people, is that I'm willing to do that. And it is interesting. I was already doing that. I was already looking at that camera. Sorry. I just automatically, when we're doing phones, I just look at that camera. And so it was just a second nature to me to use resources I disagree with, get positive out of it, and throw the stuff out that's based upon bad theological presuppositions. So, sorry, off the top of my head, it's not. I just don't make lists of books in my head to just be able to whip out. So you'll notice on Twitter, people are constantly asking me, give me resources on this, resources on that. I skip them because that's not what I do. Sorry.
Sorry. Quick second question. I just wanted to ask if you were going to be interested in reviewing Bart Ehrman's newest book since you were talking about him today. And I saw Michael Kruger post an article reviewing it on the Gospel Coalition. So
yeah, Kruger said it wasn't anything groundbreaking. I got the Audible of it. I haven't listened to it yet. It's, you know, Kruger said there really wasn't much to talk about because it was just sort of a historical survey. But I may get around to it. I don't know.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye. 877-753-3341. Let's talk to Brandon. Hello, Brandon.
Hey, Dr. White. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, got a quick question. It may be a simple answer, maybe extended one. But in your discussion with Stephen Anderson, with when you all were talking in your dividing line program, when you talked about Hebrews 8:9 and the Jeremiah 31:32, and you were talking about the difference in the Hebrew text between the Gaal and the Baal, and how the Septuagint picks up on the variant reading there. I had a question on should we look to as, I guess, the correct manuscript tradition? Should we follow like the Septuagint, since the author of Hebrews kind of goes that way, or just kind of a follow up on the that end of that dividing line?
Yeah,
I just had a question about that.
It's obviously an interesting question. The Reformation answer was the Old Testament in Hebrew and the New Testament in Greek. But the problem you face there is just that. You have in the New Testament a recognition of different lines of transmission over time. And the Reformers themselves did not have the same information that we have today concerning the state of the text in that day. I mean, until the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the oldest Hebrew manuscripts we had were the Masoretic text from 9 centuries after the time of Jesus. And so that sort of causes a problem in being able to compare those traditions. The early church answer was the Greek Septuagint. And part of that was because of the early break between the synagogue and the church, which was a very negative thing in the sense that the knowledge of Hebrew became much less prevalent than it should have been. You have the reality of only a few people having knowledge of those things. And that's a problem in and of itself. They didn't know Hebrew. They didn't. They weren't able to study it in that way. So the early church's answer to that question was you use the Greek Septuagint. I think the best answer to that question is you default to the Hebrew, always looking to the Greek Septuagint, and always with a recognition that there are places where you have these variations, and when those variations come up, then you have to see what the apostolic writers were doing. And there are times when they clearly preferred the Septuagint over the Hebrew. So at that point, you got to do what you got to do. And they both represent what the apostles had access to at that time and were utilizing and things like that. So I'm uncomfortable saying, well, you only use this when you have more available to you.
Yeah. And I read Bruce, what Bruce had to say about it. And that was, wasn't very satisfactory, I guess. I've got Logos, a pretty extensive Logos program, and there wasn't much on there, and I was curious your take on that, but I appreciate it. Appreciate you taking the call.
All right, thank you.
Hey, we're gonna try to get you to Knoxville sometime and deal with some of these King James only revival issues out here.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you, sir.
Bye bye. All right. Let's see here. Let's go to Elizabeth. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Pretty good.
That's good. The Bluetooth seems to be working for you.
Actually, during the last call, there was a static, and what's happened is now it's behind because it's trying to catch up, but it hasn't caught up yet. So it's slowly catching up, but it's more lagged than it was. So we'll work on it and where we're putting the transmitter, and there's probably a way for me to hit a button and reconnect it and get rid of all that. But knowing me, I'll hit a button and you'll all be listening to a local rock station or something.
Well, that's the marvels of technology.
Yes.
Okay. After listening to your wonderful explanation this morning, the clarity about bartering, and I've explained time difference when I'm working with people, but Matthew 12:40, when I came out of the legalistic Jewish teaching, I was, this is what tripped me up many times until I really went into studying it, but what has always gotten me about that section is how people misuse it.
Right.
Because I was saying, oh, he couldn't have been 3 days and three nights in the tomb.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, but the word tomb isn't in there. How do you explain to people about Matthew 12:40?
I addressed this, I forget when it was. I gave sort of a study on what the sign of Jonah was, the issue of Jonah going into Sheol in Jonah itself, where he says that's where he's gone, and primarily in reference to the Muslim misuse of this text as an argument against the idea of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus and things like that. But specifically, it sounds like what you're addressing is how do you get 3 days and three nights out of Friday to Sunday morning? Is that what you're referring to?
Well, some people have tried to use that on me, and I point out that it doesn't say tomb. It says heart of the earth. So it's going back, going back and studying what really is the heart of the earth. And am I correct in that the heart of the earth is the confines of Jerusalem?
I had never heard that. I've never heard that.
A couple of teachers did. That's why I'm asking you, because I've heard it different times in different studies, but never from something that you have taught, because I've listened to most of your debates with Muslims and about Islam, so I knew that you had brought that up, but I had never heard anything addressing the heart of the earth.
Yeah, probably because as far as I've always understood it, and I think if we looked at the parallel passages in Mark and Luke, that would be really useful. And in fact, hold on just a second here. I might be able to do that. Yeah, look at that. I love accordance.
I have it up in King James, Darby, World, and Literal in front of me, as well as a few others.
Let me... why isn't that coming up? It takes me to Matthew 8:16, which is not what I want. Oh, wait a minute. The sign for this generation. There we go. See, three nights in heart of the earth, and you don't really have that in Luke. Just as Jonah became a sign of the Ninevites, so the Son of Man be to this generation. That's different. Mm-hmm. And Mark is just, and a sign will not be given except the sign of Jonah. So you only have that in Matthew. and I've never heard that described as Jerusalem, and Jesus was more than 3 days in Jerusalem, so I'm not sure how that would follow. I've just always understood the Son of Man being 3 days and three nights the heart of the earth as having the parallel to the other statements in regards to Jonah. And the issue, as I understand it, is very clearly related to the death on before sunset, and it's just simply a way of describing the time period, and the Jews would not have understood a literalistic 72-hour understanding, because they didn't even, I mean, it was really interesting to me, hours in the ancient world were not 60 minutes.
Right.
They took the day, if it was like 12 hours of daylight, they divided that into 12. That would be about 60 minutes. But during the winter, it's going to be much smaller, and the nighttime hours will actually be longer. So that's really confusing. that really throws a lot of people off. And so that needs to be understood. So when someone says 3 days and three nights, we think 12-hour periods, they counted any portion of a day as a day. And therefore, no one would have been confused back then. We're only confused about now because it uses a different temporal system than we use. But I had never heard I had never heard that description of the heart of the earth as Jerusalem. I would like to see where that comes from.
Okay, I'm never going to fall on my sword for something that isn't early Orthodox teaching. So that's why I wanted to run it past you, because I've been looking for some more people that had said it, and I couldn't find anybody early who had said it.
I've just not heard it, yeah.
Okay.
Okay,
thank you very much.
All right.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, we had another breakup, and there's big gap. I just don't know. I guess I can't write any shit. I'm just not sure which button I'm supposed to hit to do stuff. But you've had that happen when you're listening on Bluetooth, where it'll get an interruption and then it starts buffering, and that's basically what it's done. So it slowly catches up over time. So technology's technology. Okay, let's talk to Cullen. Hi, Cullen.
Hey, Dr. White. I am just calling because I've been encountering I have relatives and friends that are atheists and skeptical and like my father, for example, is a former Mormon, and when he left, he sort of broke off from all religion. And I was curious, also just because I'm interested, you've gotten me, interested and like loving apologetics, seeking to make God, known and really understood among people. And so I appreciate that, but I was just curious if you could give me, a good resource for like early church history and, sort of how the Bible, the New Testament specifically came to be compiled. I've heard a lot of your work, but I didn't know if there was a book that you could tell me that would get me educated on the subject of both the early church history starting from the apostles and then also the beginnings of the Bible and the compilation of the scriptures.
There's a lot of stuff there. We just recently put up a video or linked to a video with Dr. Michael Kruger. Oh, goodness. Dr. Michael Kruger, who he and I had a conversation nothing I can do about that. On the subject of canon and his books, he has two books on the subject of the canon that would be of great assistance to you. Now you're gone. Okay, just leave it right there. And so I would recommend those to you. As far as early church history goes, there's all sorts of single volume works. Owen Chadwick has one on the early church. Then you've got your multi-volume works like Philip Schaff that, you know, has multiple volumes on the subject. Some of those are older, some of them are newer. All depends on what you're looking at. But again, this is the one area where I'm sort of like, when people ask for all sorts of books, it's like, Google, Amazon.
I think myself, as well as a lot of people, just trust you and trust your consistency of the scriptures.
Well,
we don't want somebody that's off of, you know, out of the left field.
Yeah, well, anything. You know. It doesn't matter what you're reading. It doesn't. When I mention something like Owen Chadwick's work, or Kenneth Scott Lauderette's two volume set, or something like that. It doesn't matter who wrote it. Even if it's Dr. Kruger, you have to examine anything by anybody for consistency. Every author has blind spots. Every author has biases. Again, that's why I'm sort of glad I went to Fuller Seminary to start off with, because I was forced to deal with that from the start. I am concerned about folks that will say, well, you know, that particular author believed X, Y, or Z. Therefore, I can't trust what he says on anything else. There's a lot of people like that. And you end up with a very small amount of resources you can actually utilize when you take that that type of an attitude. So that's something to keep in mind. When you do read these works, they will have bibliographies, and those, you know, data mining and resource mining in bibliographies and footnotes is sort of a lost art, but it shouldn't be. That's extremely important to be able to do that. It's not like, well, Schaff does have some of that. He's old enough that his citation methodology is a little bit different. But when you find something that's good generally, then you see what sources they use. That'll give you leads as to where to go from there.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, and I appreciate your ministry. And I'm really glad I got to talk to you. I've been waiting a while to find a question to ask you, so here I am.
All right. Thanks, Cullen. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, sir. All right. God bless.
All right. Bye-bye. Yeah. All right, let's take these two calls, and then we'll wrap it up from there. Let's talk with Ross in Philadelphia. Hi, Ross. Hello, Ross. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Oh, cool. Okay. So my question was on compatibilist free will. Basically, I was trying to, at my job a few weeks ago, explain to a coworker of mine who's not a believer the Reformed perspective on the will. As I was talking to him, I was pretty much trying to explain that while, yes, God has decreed all things, you know, whatsoever to come to pass, but man is not forced to do anything, that a man acts upon the desires of his heart, to which my friend responded, well, where does the desires of his heart come from?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm just trying to, How would you communicate to someone in trying to explain to them what the Bible teaches about the will of man and the sovereignty of God and the justice and the judgment of God?
Well, I'm not sure that's a conversation to be had with an unbeliever. I don't see the apostles attempting to unpack the sovereignty of God and the relationship of man's will and God's will, autonomous will versus creaturely will or anything else in talking to unbelievers. These are spiritual things. They're spiritually apprised, and I don't think you're going to get anywhere, to be perfectly honest with you. As it is, it's rare enough to find a Christian who is submissive to the will of God to the point where they'd be willing to say, I will accept what the word teaches, even if it's against my traditions or something else. You've got all sorts of Christians. It won't even go that far. So I'm not sure that you've got much of a open ground in talking to a person who is still functioning on a position that I'm just going to judge whatever you present to me on my own basis. I don't see that Romans 9 is addressed to that type of a person in the first place. I mean, you know, if someone wants to, you know, if the unbeliever wants to look at the scriptures, you can say, well, the scriptures state this, but you're in rebellion against the most basic command of scripture, and that is to repent and believe. And so obviously anything it says beyond that, based upon your having repented and believed, is really not going to be something that is of great import to you. But, you know, I know in a scholastic situation, you might have to address some of those things, but it seems like somewhat like beating your head against the proverbial wall, because it's in answering that question with believers, you still have to come to a point with the believer to say, well, the final statements that Scripture makes is that the judge of all the earth will do right. He's done all things to the praise of his glorious grace. He will be vindicated, or literally justified. That's what dikaiō, the Greek term, the justification, theodicy is we don't realize that's theos and dikaiō put together. So it's the justification of God. God will be justified in light of his own purposes in the final judgment in regards to what he has done. And you get down to that final point where someone says, well, where did that person's desires come from? And that really is where you get to, that's where Paul gets to, and he says, who are you, O man, who answers back to God? Because fundamentally, God has said, I'm going to judge you based upon your acting upon what you wanted to do. And if you come back and say, yeah, well, if he's totally sovereign, then even that, and it's like, wait a minute, God's already told you you're not a machine, you're not a robot, he's going to judge you on the basis of that. If you go beyond that to say, well, I reject that, then who are you, O man, who answers back to God? The only person that's really addressed to is a person who has already bowed the knee. That no one else is going to find that to be at all a relevant response. And so even though inter-varsity or inter-Christian debates on this subject can often be rather heated and things like that, at least there is the presumed, if not always true, but presumed reality that everyone in the room is willing to submit themselves to the authority of Scripture. If they're, you know, and we've recognized that's not always the case, and we've got the issue of tradition and stuff like that. But at least that's the assumption that we're operating on. Talking to the unbeliever at that point, you know, it's sort of like trying to explain the comfort that comes from an understanding of a person's union with Christ. I mean, it's like trying to describe to the blind person the beauty of the sunset. It you can't do it. They don't have the necessary equipment to be able to really understand what it is you're saying. And I think you'll end up going around in circles for a long time.
I when I listen to other Reformed apologists, sometimes they'll say something like if you read John Piper, well, I'm not sure he's a Reformed apologist, but he's Reformed. He'll say he'll appeal to mystery a lot. He'll say, well, this isn't exhausting the mystery, but so is that kind of what we would do? Maybe not in a, you know, in an evangelizing context, but is that sort of how far God's given us? It's just an appeal to mystery.
I'm not an expert on Dr. Piper's use of the term mystery. I've not read enough to be able to comment on that. I hesitate. You know, the term mystery has a proper utilization in the New Testament, primarily focused upon the revelation of the nature of the church. I know that there is a proper use of the term mystery in Christian theology, but unfortunately, I think there's a lot of improper uses of the term mystery to allow for contradiction to exist and emphasizing as equal truths things that biblically are not equal truths. So my Lutheran friends love the term mystery to completely avoid discussing the issue of election and predestination and things like that. So I'm a little allergic to the term unless it's properly defined, and I don't know what you'd be referring to specifically in regards to Piper's utilization of it.
Because I don't want to, even in a, you know, believing context, I don't want to say, well, you know, some things are just, you know, maybe not an appeal to mystery, because that word I do find allergic, as you said.
Right.
But
right.
An appeal to faith, maybe? Is that what?
Well,
I would say submission.
I would say submission to the supremacy of God's truth, the consistency of God's truth, and the reality that God has the right to say this far and no farther. So that's really where we chafe. I've used the illustration many times before, but it seems to me that Calvin got that very clearly. This far and no farther. God has the right to say, this is the extent of my revelation. I'm not going beyond this. And Edwards tried to get the flashlight of human reason and go beyond that, and ended up stubbing his toe and falling into a cactus. So I would not view it so much as just simply faith, but a submission to God's right to be God, and that we're not, and that living in time as we do with such minimal amount of knowledge of the entire universe, that it's not good for us to think that on the basis of that, we can somehow judge God unworthy of belief and obedience to his commands. Okay.
Thanks, Dr. White.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Thanks for your call. God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. One more, and let's talk to Justin. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Dr. White.
Howdy.
Hey, so I had a question on Mark chapter 7, verse 16.
There is no Mark 7, 16.
There's a textual variant there.
Yeah, there is no Mark 7, 16.
And, yeah. So I was looking at the NA 28, and it just on the ESV it goes from 15 to 17.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to know how I'm actually teaching through that in a Bible study. I want to inform the people in my Bible study. Why is this verse not included in the NA 28 or the ESV?
Yeah, well, the simplest answer is that when first of all, we're in Mark, and it would be really, really super cool if this was a part of my manuscript, P45, but unfortunately it's not, because it would be really, really cool to know whether it contained it or not. It's a short enough section that we can't really tell in light of the condition of the manuscript. Mm-hmm. But so we don't have any papyri for this particular section of Mark. Maybe someday we will. So the two earliest manuscripts you're going to have for Mark at verse 15 of chapter 7 is Sinaiticus Vaticanus, both of which do not contain it. Then you have at least three other unseals. I'm just looking here at the Nusseyland information, and two different translations that likewise do not have it. And it is, of course, the majority reading, but when you have the earliest manuscripts and you have translations not possessing it, and it is a phrase that is well known in Scripture. In other words, let him who has ears hear is a common phraseology, and so it's much more likely in light of it. There's no reason why it would disappear from those earlier manuscripts.
Yeah.
It's not like it's offensive or something. It's not like there'd be scribes sitting there going, oh, we can't repeat that. It's much more likely that having said the things that Jesus says, that an early scribe had memorized some of the other sayings of Jesus where he uses this phrase and thought that he used it here as well and inadvertently added it, thinking that it was there, than to have inadvertently deleted it. It does not, by any stretch of the imagination, change the meaning. This is really a variant that you could call meaning wise a throwaway variant, because there's just There's nothing unique about it. The phrase appears elsewhere. It wouldn't change what the meaning was one way or the other. And so it's good to be able to explain it, but it's also pretty easy to understand how it could have been added in inadvertently. You've memorized a similar passage someplace else, and so you assume that it's there. There was, just wasn't any reason for someone to go, oh, I don't like that. I'm gonna get rid of it, because there's nothing offensive about it in and of itself. So that's gonna be the reasoning of the textual scholars in looking at it that way. But we will have, I bet within 5 years we will have the CBGM data on this reading, and we'll be able to take a look at it then. But that's just coming around the corner, so we'll see what
I know that's
the next one next
I think
edition
that'll
be
says.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. Thank you very much for answering my question, and God bless you and your ministry. I know it's tough doing what you do. So thank you, Dr. White.
Okay. Thanks, Justin. I appreciate it. All right, God bless.
All right, have
all
right. Good day.
Okay, bye-bye. All righty. Well, there you go. We got our phone lines in, and we got lots of different topics addressed, and we're going to need to put our new Bluetooth technology someplace else. I just think it's got a lot of there's a lot of electronics between just this close up, so might need to hang it from the put it up there, I don't know, but two or three times it I'd hear the static, and then it's like wah wah wah, it's all delayed, and the latency got really bad, and then it gets crazy, because when you're hearing what you said 2 seconds after you said it, then it's it doesn't work.
But they guaranteed it, man.
I'm not giving up on it yet, because that'd be a whole lot better than this, but. The stick in the rock worked, and that's the important part. So, anyway, thanks for watching Dividing Lines today. Oh, good grief! I even had a note. Where'd the note go? Where did the note go? The note disappeared. Well, isn't that great? Write yourself a note, and then the note disappears. can't blame the Bluetooth for that. No, I have no idea where that program just like crashed. It just died. It went bye bye. So I won't use that for notes in the future, I guess. Haven't mentioned it for a week or so, but I need to mention it again. We have the Zambia leg of my upcoming trip. We know when that's going to be. So now we're working on the Joburg part, and then moving out from there to London, and looking at talking to people in both Glasgow and Belfast. Doesn't have to be either or at that point, but we're trying to find locations for debates and things like that. And obviously, I know time's going by quickly, but anyway, we want to be able to put all these things together. And but we need your assistance. We need your help to be able to afford to fly to all of these different locations. And so we made reference to this a couple weeks ago. But if you want to help make these things possible, these types of trips and then the debates and the presentations are literally around the world. There is a donation link at aomin.org. You can see the travel fund there, and you can specifically help us to be able to do these things. So we do need your assistance to make that happen. And I just need to let people know about it. And I keep forgetting. I jump into phones or topics or whatever else it might be, and then I get off and go, oh, I forgot to do that again. So if you agree with us that this is the type of information that needs to be distributed around the world, that we need to be of encouragement in other places, not just here in the United States, then we need your help to be able to get there. So if you can help us, we'd really appreciate it. The donation link is at aomin.org. There's a travel subcategory that you can give to. So thank you very much for your consideration. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time. God bless.